From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Always nice to have you along. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We open the week with a conversation about affirmative consent. That's the new standard on college campuses concerning sexual interaction. Both partners in an encounter are expected to give verbal, affirmative consent at every step. Critics have recently alleged that the standards are not working because young women in particular are being taught that sex they regret might actually be assault.
We welcomed Allison O'Malley, Chief Executive Officer of Resolve, and Lauren Berger, Education and Outreach Specialist at Restore. They discussed the criticism of affirmative consent and weighed in on whether it's working as intended.
I'm going to share a brief experience. So when I was working on college campuses during 2015, 2016 with the affirmative consent idea and trying to educate students about that, I'm 50 years old. And when I reflected and developed curriculum to think about how do you prepare students for a yes means yes compared to a no means no conversation, it was challenging for me just having grown up in a different time and instructing young people about the agency over their bodies, the importance of that agency, and mutual respect. Because growing up when I did in the 70s and 80s, women were just conditioned differently. And there is a what was often considered rite of passage for us in the 80s and 90s even, is not rite of passage anymore. You have much more say now. Culturally, we're still not there.
Can I, for a second, when you say rite of passage,
yeah,
can you be a little bit more specific?
Yeah, although I, you know, certainly growing up in the 80s and 70s and 80s, I learned that women can have it all. But the actual enculturization of that was not consistent. So women's bodies were still considered playthings for men in my generation.
So a rite of passage was that you're going to have a sexual experience that feels off or
yeah,
wrong.
But, right.
You know, that's what men do and that's what happens.
Yep.
Okay.
Exactly. So I think that some of this, the process of educating and embracing this idea of agency is really deeply rooted in our culture, and it's challenging to overcome. And I struggle with kind of remorse after the fact. Geez, I didn't like that now, and I want to do something about it. I think there is a personal responsibility piece that we bear in affirmative consent. It's mutual responsibility. And sometimes we make choices we're sorry we made. It doesn't mean that we should pursue some sort of recourse.
A legal action.
Most of this action is not in a legal sense. It may be only within your campus or only within your business organization. So I think there's many, many strengths in the notion of affirmative consent, but it's something we have to embrace at a cultural level more than in a codified way.
Okay. How do you feel about that, Lauren?
I think Allie brings up a lot of great points, this idea of knowing something and yet in cultural application, maybe not so much. And this idea of students coming onto a campus in college at age 18, most of them, and having not a ton of information on what that actually means in practice. Like maybe we learned it in an abstract sense, but not so much in terms of application that not only is it both parties' responsibility to acquire affirmative consent, but that we can have sexual activity that is about pleasure, and that's not often a component in sex education if students have comprehensive or worthwhile sex education at all.
Is that changing? Is that changing now?
It's tough to say. I think in a lot of public schools, it's still very a fraught subject in terms of sex ed in general, and it mostly centers around pregnancy prevention and sexually transmitted infection prevention. So that's mostly through a heterosexual lens. So already there's some components of sex education that are being missed. And in many ways, the idea of desire and pleasure gives people a very uncomfortable feeling when talking in middle and high school classrooms. So in a lot of ways, I think that that's a gap in learning. And then when you have students who have varying degrees of knowledge or experience coming on campus, they are going to have some of that crossover in coercion, regret, not sure, gray area, and there is little option for that recourse. And so affirmative consent policies allow one option in terms of a student conduct proceeding, but it also opens up the conversation for people to have other options, because most of the time when folks are assaulted, it's by someone that they know. It's by someone that they've met a couple times or is a friend of a friend, and not somebody that they want to see thrown in jail. And most students without an affirmative consent policy and a conduct proceeding would have no recourse. And often the only result that they want to see is they want to feel safe on campus. And so it may even allow for, in the future, other types of restorative justice or different options in terms of adjudication.
Next, a local police officer is making history. Tiffany Gatson is the first African-American female officer hired by the Greece Police Department ever. The department currently has 100 members. 97 of their police officers are white.
Gatson says she realized she wanted to become a police officer when she was in high school. The tension between police and communities of color in recent years did not dissuade her. In this clip, you'll hear Officer Gatson share her thoughts on that tension and why she thinks more people of color do not pursue policing.
With what we see where people on the media, where it's portrayed with police brutality, you do have a lot of, what should I say, disgruntled people, especially in the Black community, or I'll just say minority community altogether, where they feel, why would I want to be a part of something that's tearing us down? And again, these are the words that you hear sometimes when you ask the question, well, why would you not want to be a police officer? Well, you know, they're pulling us over. We're getting shot. They're doing this to us. And so when you have that negative view of something, you're not going to want to be a part of it. And you know, it's sad. I understand the frustration from what you see on the media. And again, sometimes people will put on there, they'll place what they want you to see in order to get a certain reaction from you. I wish, you know, they could see the training and everything that's impacted with, you know, policing, so they can really see, you know, how we're doing a job, and it's not, you know, trying to use brutality and all these other, you know, nasty antics when interacting with people. But again, if you see a negative view of something, of course you're not going to want to be a part of that, you know. And I feel in order to change it, we have to have better community relations with the people in the community, and it's not something that's going to be done overnight. It's going to take a long time. I don't expect, you know, being the first African-American female with Greece to make, you know, just sunshine and rainbows and make everybody want to change their mind. But if I can be a start, if I can be a gateway to that, I'm happy about that. Even if someone's not even particularly interested in law enforcement, for me to not even know a person, but they read my article, they're listening to this, and if that inspires them, I'm happy with that.
Do you feel any extra pressure being and when we say the first, she is the first African-American woman right now and ever, Chief?
Yes, ever.
Ever.
In the Greece Police Department.
In the Greece Police Department.
Yeah.
Do you feel extra pressure that comes with that?
Sometimes, yes. And again, being honest, I'm a straight shooter. You'll have people of the same race as me like, oh, you're going to look out for me, right, if you pull me over because you know we're both Black. And my thing is, I don't care what race somebody is, I'm going to treat everyone equally. I'm on an equal playing field, because I wouldn't want somebody to treat me higher up or less than because of the skin that I'm in. You know, I'm professional. At the same time, I try to be relatable to people, because you want to give that, you want to, you know, project a human, what should I say, a human vibe to people. No one wants to feel like they're talking to a robot. And yeah, I'm Police Officer Gatson. Be relatable to people, be humble, be respectful. But at the same time, I'm going to treat everyone the same way. I'm not going to treat you less or treat you greater than because we share a same commonality in race or skin tone.
Okay. And to make sure I understand something, to clarify, you know, you've several times in this conversation, you've raised the point that in particular, people of color in this country see in the media a portrayal of police community relations as being a certain kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to understand if you feel that and look, let's just be as blunt as we all need to be. I mean, like, I'm not looking for sort of an easy answer here. But do you think the media has done a poor job or an inaccurate job of portraying police community relations, of portraying individual incidents that have resulted in violence or death? Has the media done a disservice, or do you think the media is reporting on it accurately?
It's a mixture of both. I mean, if you're going to play a video, why not play it from start to finish? I understand you do have, you know, a certain time frame to show a video clip. You can't just dwell on something forever. But if you're going to talk about something, talk about it from start to finish. You know, don't just play the clip where it's going to get more ratings and people, oh, you know, if people look at this, look at how many ratings we'll get and how people will view the police. Play it from start to finish. And if that police officer is in the wrong, then that police officer is in the wrong. If you played a video clip from start to finish and you say, okay, that police officer was actually doing their job, okay, that's fine too. Whatever the outcome is, that's fine. But if you're going to address the situation, talk about it for its entirety, not just what's going to spark, you know, a rise in people.
Yeah, I take that point. And I think that there are times where a 20-second chunk of a video can seem shocking, can seem wrong, and absent full context, the hard thing to do in the social media age is to wait. Because I'm not saying every full piece of video, and I don't think the officer is saying every full piece of video is fully exonerating of behavior, but at the same time, absent context, I do think it's valuable to wait, but people don't want to wait right now. So I hear that from you, that admonition that when we can, seek out the full video. And then when there's wrongdoing, call it out.
Yes, absolutely. If, like I said, if I'm not trying to sit here and advocate that, oh, no police officer can do any wrong. I'm a realist. If you play the full clip and that police officer is not, you know, doing their due diligence and not doing what they've sworn to be, then absolutely, that should be put out there. They're not doing their job. Just the same, if that officer is doing their job, show that as well. Don't just show where they're using defensive tactics to get this person to comply. Show the part where they ask this person just using verbal to follow my commands. They're trying to talk to this person. Show that part as well. Don't just show, you know, the down and dirty part of the clip.
Finally, new data shows that it's getting harder to get rich in America. The data shows that breaking into the top 10% of earners is twice as hard today as it was a generation ago. We welcomed a panel to discuss why that is and what it means for our country.
In this clip, you'll hear small business owner Jay Levine. He runs a production studio with 7 employees. He's nearing the age of 50, and he says a lot has changed.
I'm not complaining, because I view my own story through the prism of recognizing I had certain advantages that most people did not have, that I was able to attend an Ivy League school and have an Ivy League network, that my family was certainly not a family of means, but at the same time, I was in a position that I was never going to starve, that if I had a child, he's never going to starve. And that allowed me to take risks as an entrepreneur that a lot of Americans would not be able to take those risks or have access to those kinds of contacts. So I don't want anyone to think that I'm complaining when I state it. But so when I look at my story and I say, all right, I've done okay, but it's been challenging. And particularly the challenge has been to reach a point of real economic security to build wealth. Again, not just to get by, not just to do pretty well, but to actually build wealth if you are successful. And I feel that, obviously, I know many people from college who've been professionally successful, but building wealth is something different. Achieving economic security is something different. And I know that there's not a lot of sympathy, perhaps shouldn't be a lot of sympathy for this out there. But the reality is, would we all agree that if somebody has a household where they're making $200,000, that would generally be considered successful by most people's standards?
Yeah.
However, people who have a $200,000 household, by and large, do not feel they have any real economic security. They do not feel that they have the ability to retire with economic security, having sent their children to college, which are just basic benchmarks for American success. And that has largely gone away. And there's a combination of reasons for it. But one of the main reasons that struck me as everyone was making their comments earlier was simply that the incentive for companies to employ people in highly compensated positions over the long term has almost entirely gone away. And we saw that creeping down through the 90s and the aughts. But to me, there was a sea change with the 2008 crash in that companies decided that they now had license to just purely contract employ as many people as they possibly could in a sort of shameless way. And I think there was sort of a degree of shame associated with...
No benefits.
Right.
Poor
right.
pay, yeah.
So that even people who are rather highly skilled in the job market, you know, we talk about the gig economy. You know, I have a lot of great gig economy skills. It still doesn't add up to economic security, though. And that's, I think that is a big difference between now and the economy that we expected coming out of college in the 90s. There are people who are obviously born into wealth. There are people who can marry into wealth. That's a strategy. And there are people who can attempt to achieve wealth and build wealth, you know, professionally. And my understanding, looking around at my classmates from the 90s, is that hardly any of them, And there are a couple exceptions sort of in the entertainment industry. But in general, nobody has really been able to build wealth on a professional level in terms of being an entrepreneur or being a highly successful professional unless their goal coming out of college was simply to pursue wealth. Essentially, unless they were going into investment banking and at Penn, knowing Wharton students, there were plenty of those people. But if your main goal in life wasn't to accumulate wealth, if you were pursuing any other track, the way the economy has gone, you are unlikely to have built much significant wealth.
And when you talked about this originally, I thought, well, that's kind of a tautology. The people who got rich are the ones who tried to get rich. But what actually, I stepped back and I thought, no, that's actually quite a problem. If the only people who can get rich are the ones who are sort of hell-bent on getting rich.
Because that's not the system we were sold.
Right.
We were sold the system that said, essentially, if you were really good at your job and you work hard, if you're a talented person, then you should end up with a basic level of American security. The idea of sending your kids to college and being able to retire with a little bit of economic security, that didn't used to be a fantasy. That didn't used to be like someone who felt like a lottery winner, which younger people may not even understand that. That used to be considered a normal thing, that if you simply worked hard and were good at your job and didn't screw up royally, you were expected to get there. And a lot of people, in fact, basically got there with union jobs. It wasn't even necessarily considered management or high-level professionals who were the only ones who could achieve that. People who just had any kind of skilled labor and worked hard for a few decades, they were going to achieve those basic things. I don't think anyone thinks that's the case anymore.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, that's Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan, I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll talk to you Monday.